Hi there, I'm Marco Werman. Every day our program has hundreds of thousands of listeners from all around the globe. If everyone who listened to The World donated during our drive, we'd be set for a while. That's just not possible for everyone. Times are tough. But if you are in a position to give, and if our show has touched you, if it's helped you feel more connected or perhaps more optimistic about the world around you, then please donate today at theworld.org/give. That's theworld.org/give. Thank you very much. And now, the show.
The following message is brought to you by Wise, the smart way to move money internationally. An American sends money to a friend in Australia. An Australian buys from an Indian shop online. An Indian freelancer gets paid by a client in Germany. What do all of these people have in common? They use Wise, which means they always get the real exchange rate and super low fees when managing their money across borders. And you will too. Wise also has a multi-currency debit card, so you can avoid high fees when you shop overseas, online, or in-store. Wise is designed by international people for international people. Try Wise for free at wise.com/world.
The UN Climate Summit starts to wrap up in Glasgow, but negotiators still have a lot of work. We tag along with one from the island nation of Palau who says it's a lot of pressure.
You're essentially the voice of those that could not come, the voice of those that are the most vulnerable. It's a heavy load to carry, but a worthwhile one.
Also ahead, Democrats take another crack at immigration reform, and on Veterans Day, reflections from an Afghan war vet.
I grew up the kid of a veteran as well and an active duty service member, so it's always been sort of a different day, almost like a church day, where you go and you think and reflect.
And remembering the complex legacy of F.W. de Klerk, who defended apartheid in South Africa and then helped to end it. All of that and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for joining us. For several days now, thousands of migrants have been trying to cross the border from Belarus into Poland. Polish officials accuse Belarus of manufacturing the crisis, shepherding migrants toward the EU border. Standing in the migrants' way is a barbed wire fence built by Poland. Now the Polish government is reinforcing its border with Belarus. It's planning to erect an 18-foot wall. As our Europe correspondent Orla Berry reports, Poland is not alone.
Migrants use wire cutters and tree trunks to try and break through the razor wire fence on Poland's border with Belarus this week. In one online video, Polish police can be seen spraying chemicals at the migrants trying to get through. Over a loudspeaker, a voice on the Polish side issues a warning.
Obey the law and leave this place. Staying here is forbidden.
Polish troops started building the barbed wire fence in August. But in late October, the Polish parliament voted to build an actual wall along its border with Belarus. The wall will be 250 miles long and equipped with motion sensors. In Lithuania, which also shares a border with Belarus, construction of a new steel barrier began last week. Lithuanian lawmaker Patras Austravičius tells me his country has run out of options.
I think we've been for too long naive that we are having stable and predictable neighbor as Belarus. Our common border is quite a long one. I mean, 670 kilometers. And that border is not between peoples. It's a border between the European Union and dictatorship as Belarus stands for the time of being.
In fact, Lithuania is appealing to the EU to help pay for new border walls. It's not the first time an EU member state has come looking for money to build barriers. Hungary made an appeal for cash after the migrant crisis in 2015. The EU refused. But 2 years later, Hungary erected a 100-mile-long electrified barbed wire fence along its border with Serbia. As the standoff with Belarus has escalated in recent days, the EU appears to be warming up to the idea of border fences. EU Council President Charles Michel said so on Wednesday.
We have opened the debate on the EU financing of physical border infrastructure. And this must be settled rapidly, because Polish and Baltic borders are EU borders, one for all and all for one.
For some lawmakers in Europe, though, the talk of building walls brings back bad memories.
Once we had the wall in Europe, and that was because of very sad reasons.
Corinne Carlsborough is vice chair of the EU Parliament's delegation to Belarus. Like most European lawmakers, she says Belarus is driving the current crisis by encouraging migrants to fly from countries like Syria and Iraq to Minsk and then directing them straight to the EU border. Carlsborough says harsher sanctions against Belarus are the only way forward.
The sanctions list could be much, much longer because we know people with responsibility for their human rights violation, and we know who support them and finance this regime.
And Carlsborough says Russia is playing a part in all this. Polish Prime Minister Mateusz Morawiecki went further this week.
Ale to właśnie ten ostatni atak Łukaszenki.
This is the latest attack of Lukashenko, Morawiecki said, referring to the Belarusian president. But he went on to say that the real enabler in all this is none other than Russian President Vladimir Putin. Yesterday, German Chancellor Angela Merkel called Putin, asking him to put pressure on Belarus to de-escalate the situation. But the Kremlin blames the EU, suggesting its sanctions on Belarus are the real problem. More EU sanctions are expected next week. I asked Lithuanian lawmaker Patras Austravičius if this might all backfire on the European Union.
It might, but I think Belarus has very little to offer us. They might be important for EU cargo to go to Russia and back, but I think we can find some alternatives. But Belarus is so dependent on EU market first, and second, financial services they receive from Western banks.
But Belarus might have another card up its sleeve, a pipeline that runs through the country, bringing natural gas from Russia into Europe. Today, the Belarusian president threatened to cut off the gas supply if any new sanctions are imposed. As for border walls, 12 European countries have written a letter to the EU saying they're under attack and that building physical barriers on their borders would benefit all EU member states. For the World, I'm Orla Barry.
Vice President Kamala Harris is in Paris this week. She's meeting with French President Emmanuel Macron after some recent diplomatic fallout between the two allies. France said it was blindsided in September when Australia announced it was scrapping a $64 billion French submarine deal and that the Aussies were instead partnering with the US and the UK. Reporter Rebecca Rossman in Paris has been following the vice president's trip. Rebecca, remind us, first of all, what went on with the submarine deal and why did France feel so betrayed?
So, as you mentioned, this was a $64 billion deal. France was going to supply Australia with 12 submarines. And in late September, news broke that Australia was not only breaking this contract with France, but it was entering a new partnership with the UK and the US to build a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines. France felt betrayed not only because it was losing out on this huge contract, but you have to just think about how this looks from a diplomacy perspective, right? France is an ally to the US, to the UK, and to Australia, but they're more or less being shut out of this huge defense partnership. Hence why you have this charm offensive now, starting with Biden at the G20 summit, and now Vice President Harris with this five-day visit.
So if this is kind of fence mending part two, what does Kamala Harris have to achieve this week?
What Harris has to do this week is reinforce the charm and remind French leaders that France is the oldest ally of the United States, and keeping that relationship strong is essential for both parties. But I think also beyond the submarine deal, this trip is also a chance for Harris to cement her role as a leader on a global stage. You know, this is her third international trip, her first in Europe. And she's not just meeting with Macron. She's also going to be meeting with some 24 other world leaders, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel and Italian Prime Minister Mario Draghi. So if Harris does decide perhaps maybe to run for president one day, fostering these kinds of relationships on a global scale will be an essential part of her track record.
So what has Harris done so far in Paris and what boxes has she checked off?
Well, yesterday there was a bilateral meeting held with Harris and Macron where they discussed the climate crisis, global health issues, including, of course, COVID-19, and regional security concerns. This morning, she attended a Veterans Day ceremony, and this evening she spoke alongside other global leaders at the Paris Peace Forum, which was held by Macron. The theme of this year's conference was the global response to COVID-19, and Harris dedicated her speech to talking about the role that inequality plays in managing the crisis.
We must look critically at the norms that are holding people back from achieving all that they can. To get at the root of this challenge, We must look critically at the long-standing systems and structures that are fractured and fissured.
So she said the key to fixing these issues is global cooperation. Tomorrow, she'll also be attending a conference on Libya aimed at promoting fair and peaceful elections there in December. So a lot on her plate.
Rebecca, how would you say the vice president is being seen by the French? Are they paying much attention to her visit?
Her own personal charm offensive is working out quite well so far. People like her here. French media has been talking a lot about Harris as sort of the ultimate symbol of the American dream, as the child of immigrants and the fact that she's the first woman of color to hold such a high position in office. And she also did something that I think is quite noteworthy. On Tuesday, one of the first visits she made was to the Pasteur Institute, where she met with two scientists, one American and one French, who are researching COVID-19. And while she was there, she spoke about her mom, who was a scientist who spent time working at the Pasteur Institute. And she talked about how much her mom enjoyed working there with researchers from around the world. And once again, she conveyed this message of the importance of global partnerships. And I think that was a nice touch and a good way to make this visit feel more personal for the French.
Mm.
But I think the ultimate test for Harris is going to be how the France-US relationship looks by the end of this week. We'll have to see if it's fully repaired or not.
Reporter Rebecca Rossman in Paris telling us about the visit there by Vice President Kamala Harris. Thanks a lot, Rebecca.
Thanks, Marco.
COVID cases are on the rise again in Europe, with Russia and Eastern Europe getting hit the hardest. Vaccination rates are lower there, but right now no part of Europe seems safe from the latest surge. To discuss this is Dr. Eric Topol from Scripps Research in San Diego. Why are we seeing the surge in Europe right now?
Well, there are multiple reasons, the most important of which is the lack of vaccination. There are large numbers of people, particularly in Eastern and Central Europe, but also throughout Europe, that are not vaccinated. Along with that, of course, there's waning immunity in many countries, especially in Western Europe. Also, the lack of mitigation, the mask and distancing, that's been relaxed in many countries, but it's the lack of vaccination. The two countries that stand out are doing well, like Spain and Portugal. They have the highest vaccination rates, over 80% of their population, and that's an important signal. Unvaccinated are driving this whole process throughout Europe. And remember, that includes teenagers and children. We saw how that really was the driver in the UK. Children and teens contribute substantially. But the biggest thing still are the adults that remain unvaccinated. And only a couple of countries are above that 80% threshold. Countries like, for example, Austria, where parts of Austria announced a lockdown today, they still have a higher vaccination rate than the U.S. So that just shows you the vulnerability if you are in the 60% vaccination level. It's just not enough.
Doctor, right through the pandemic, it seems that as goes Europe, the U.S. follows a similar pattern. What are the lessons for the U.S. and other countries, given what Europe is going through right now?
Well, the U.S. needs to heed this warning. We are even less vaccinated than any of the countries in Western Europe. And so we're at 58%, where the Austria, one of the lowest, is at 63%, and most of them are considerably higher. So our vaccination rates are low relative to what's happening throughout Europe. Also, our mitigation has been relaxed. Our acceptance of boosters so far has been modest. We're just getting started with teens and children. So we are basically sitting ducks for having a surge in the U.S. unless we really take aggressive measures.
Yeah, what do those aggressive measures look like?
Well, we really should have vaccinations mandated in an accelerated and expanded fashion. It's unfortunate we had to resort to mandates, but they are working, and we have to override the lack of willingness to have vaccination rates as high as they should be. They should be well over 80% by this point. Also, we need to get back the basics of mitigation. We need to get rapid home tests, distribute those widely, freely throughout the U.S., to get medical grade masks distributed widely throughout the U.S. We need to counter aggressively the disinformation and misinformation that's propelling a lot of the resistance to get vaccinated. And so there's so many things that we could do that we're not doing right now.
So, Dr. Topol, as you look over at Europe, how concerned are you today that the U.S. is going to have another surge like many parts of Europe right now?
You know, I tend to be very optimistic, but at this point, everything is going in the wrong direction right now in the United States. Hospitalizations have stopped going down. Test positivity is going up. deaths are starting to go up again as well. And we are just in the earliest stages of another surge. We can take actions. It still remains possible for us to prevent a fifth wave in the United States. But all the factors look quite concerning. So it's very likely, unless we are more aggressive about this, that we're going to be facing a significant surge, unfortunately.
Dr. Eric Topol is Executive Vice President of Scripps Research. He joined us from San Diego. Thank you very much for speaking with us, Doctor.
Oh, thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. If you're caught trafficking drugs, you face execution by hanging. Simple as that. That's the law in Singapore, the Southeast Asian city-state. But many Singaporeans are wondering if the latest case with a death sentence that is now working its way through the legal system there is simply too cruel. And now Singapore's government is facing international pressure for a reprieve. The World Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen has been following the story and joins me now. Who is this man facing execution, and why is this case causing people in Singapore to question the harshness of the laws there?
Yeah, well, Marco, his name is Naga Entran Dharmalingam. He's originally from Malaysia, and back in 2009, when he was just 21, he got a really small amount of heroin, the equivalent of 3 tablespoons. He put it in a baggie, taped it to his leg, and went to Singapore, and obviously got caught. Now, 3 tablespoons is not that much heroin. It's actually just above the amount considered, you know, quote-unquote trafficking in most countries, but Singapore has this unyielding, mandatory death penalty for traffickers. And on top of that, Mr. Dharmalingam has been evaluated in prison by specialists who say he is intellectually challenged, that he has an IQ of 69. And his lawyer says his reasoning is of that of a 5-year-old. That's the lawyer's words. Even Mr. Dharmalingam's family says that he doesn't really comprehend what's going on. So that's why people are wondering, does this person really deserve to die?
How soon does the government plan to execute him?
Well, this is the really remarkable thing. Mr. Dharmalingam was supposed to be hung on Wednesday. The only reason he's still alive is because he got COVID in prison. And the judge said it would not follow, quote, common sense and humanity to execute someone while they still have COVID. I'm not sure I completely follow that logic, but in any case, it bought this man some more time, and the execution is paused for now, and it will proceed after he beats COVID. Still, it's going to take like an 11th hour miracle to keep him from being executed. He's already lost 2 appeals, and really his best shot now is a late-stage intervention from the highest levels of Singapore's government.
And what kind of international pressure is being brought on Singapore's government over this case?
Malaysia's prime minister has written to the prime minister of Singapore, urging him to halt it. The mogul Richard Branson has campaigned for Mr. Dharmalingam. But, you know, Singaporean authorities are really proud of their harsh laws, and they don't bend easily. You know, most people know that in Singapore, they still practice caning. The judges say that these harsh sentences and, for drug trafficking, mandatory death sentences scare drug traffickers away. But not all Singaporeans, Marco, agree with that level of harshness. Actually, only 1/3 agree with mandatory hangings. And this is the reason why. You have a person who brought a tiny amount of heroin in, a person who probably couldn't compute the consequences, but under this law, there's no mercy, no exceptions.
Caning, that's a punishment, being basically beaten with a wooden stick.
Yes, it's not a light punishment. Caned very harshly with a wooden stick. That's something that you can get for drug use. In fact, you can get a life sentence for drug use as well.
So Singapore has tough drug laws, but it's not the only place in Asia that has harsh penalties for these crimes. What kind of debate is this case sparking, not just in Singapore, but across the region?
Well, that's true. Malaysia, where this person is from, Mr. Dharmalingam, does also have extremely harsh drug laws. I think around the region, Marco, you see this duality where you have certain countries that are moving away from the really harsh drug laws. Thailand is one of them. And then you have these other countries that are really holding tight to this hardline drug war ideology, even more hardline than you would see in the U.S. Singapore is a really interesting case because in many ways it's seen as a modern city-state, you know, with gleaming shopping malls and all the trappings of a modern society. But when it comes to criminal justice, when it comes to drug laws, they really toe the line of zero tolerance. And this case is forcing Singaporeans to ask, you know, is there any room for mercy? And we'll just have to see.
The World's Southeast Asia correspondent Patrick Nguyen, thanks very much for explaining this.
Thanks, Marco.
When he took office, President Biden and the Democratic Party promised a pathway to citizenship for undocumented people in the U.S. So far, they have not delivered. The House is now debating a scaled-down version of immigration reform. The World's Daisy Contreras has the latest.
Patricia Garcia never thought she'd be helping organize rallies outside the White House. Like this one last month. Without documents, without fear, she and others chant. They're asking Congress to pass immigration reform, one that includes citizenship for undocumented people. Garcia, who's 33 and from California, has DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals. It's given her and about 700,000 others work permits and protection from deportation. It doesn't offer a pathway to citizenship, though. So Garcia, who was never open about her legal status, got involved.
It wasn't until this year that I think that so many years of being silenced, I finally was able to raise my voice and use it to my power.
But things aren't going as hoped. The latest immigration reform plan in Congress doesn't include access to citizenship. It only includes work permits for undocumented people and protections from deportation, similar to DACA, and only good for 10 years. It's far from what the Biden administration and Democrats promised, says Juliana Macedo do Nascimento. She's with United We Dream, a national immigration advocacy group.
This was a promise made during their elections last year. They came out of the gate really strong on January 20th. They had this whole entire, framework to reform our immigration system.
Lawmakers thought it'd be easy to pass immigration reform through what's known as budget reconciliation. It's a special process used to fast-track legislation, but it's gotten complicated. The Senate parliamentarian, who acts as the chamber's referee, has struck down two plans that included giving green cards to undocumented people. Macedo do Nascimento says that can be overruled.
We have over 90 law scholars who say so, that her opinion was wrong and that the Senate has the authority to disregard her opinion and include a pathway to citizenship in their reconciliation package anyways.
In the meantime, the Senate parliamentarian is set to weigh in on the latest version that includes offering work permits without green cards. This could benefit close to 8 million people. Many of them have lived in the country without documentation for over 20 years. Even passing that plan would be a big deal, says Stephen Yale Lair. He teaches immigration law at Cornell Law School in New York.
It would be sort of a way for people to say, well, this is one step toward reforming our broken immigration system. It's a down payment of sort by Congress. And while it's not as good as a direct path to legalization, it shows that we can recognize that these people are not going to be deported.
It's been about 30 years since Congress has made any changes to immigration law, he says. This is needed in whatever form it comes. Still, Macedo do Nascimento says this is a good time to push for more, since midterm elections are coming up.
We know that for immigrants, especially for the Latinx community, it'll be really hard to get them out, come out and vote for Democrats who haven't really delivered on anything for you.
That's why Patricia Garcia, the DACA recipient from California, says she's not giving up.
I think that we should still make lots of noise in order to bring change and just continue to mobilize our gente and inspire others.
She'll keep organizing, she says, as Congress keeps debating. For The World, I'm Daisy Contreras.
You're with The World. Many African migrants fled to the Mediterranean island of Cyprus. They found themselves in the middle of a political stalemate, living in tents for months, just trying to pass the time.
We're mostly on the internet and sleeping the whole day.
The tedium of seeking asylum, plus reflections on the meaning of Veterans Day. All still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. The two-week UN climate conference in Glasgow is wrapping up soon. At the heart of the summit is a series of complex negotiations between nations. What is it actually like to be one of those negotiators? The World's environment correspondent Carolyn Beeler spent the day with a negotiator from Palau, a country with a lot at stake.
Near the entrance to the summit, I meet a slight man in a black pinstripe suit. A traditional wooden hairpin keeps his long hair in a bun. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. My name is Xavier Matutaro from the Palau delegation.
We show our negative COVID tests to go through the turnstiles. So we're going in.
We are going in, that's right.
It's 7:30, first day of week two of the COP.
Yeah, we gotta rush in.
Matsutaru is already in a hurry. His country, Palau, is a string of islands with a population of about 20,000, concentrated near the coast.
As we speak 2 days ago, we just had some higher than normal floods again, if the temperature goes higher. The clock is ticking here. Something needs to happen as soon as possible.
Palau's delegation here has just 6 people. He also represents the Pacific Small Island Developing States Group. At 8 a.m., Matsutaru heads into his first meeting of the day. So where are we heading now?
We're going to go meet with the UK at this point.
Reporters aren't allowed in the negotiating sessions or informal meetings of the different alliances. So following Matsutaru around really means a lot of waiting in hallways outside of closed doors, hoping I can jump up fast enough to walk with him to his next meeting.
You've missed Xavier.
Where'd he go?
I don't know. He just disappeared.
Oh, no. He's standing here. Let's go find him. He's in a strategy session in a maze of temporary offices set up in the next exhibition hall. He pops his head out for a second, and this time I'm ready. Can I ask you one question? No.
Let me just check with New Zealand because I'm actually 5 minutes late.
Okay. Is this another hour long?
Potentially, yes.
Okay. Matsutaru's main focus right now is how to get the strongest environmental regulations for carbon markets. Palau is hoping that instead of countries merely offsetting or negating their own emissions, they do more than that.
What we need to get into is net emission reduction. And that's one of the key points of the discussion at the moment.
For him, this is directly related to the impacts of climate change that Palau is already feeling. High tides that flood the docks he used to swim off as a kid. Worsening typhoons, salt water creeping into taro fields.
It could be the difference between making it under 1.5 or not.
That's 1.5 degrees Celsius. The biggest goal here is to keep global warming below that number. Are you walking?
I am walking.
Can I walk with you?
Yes.
Yeah. You're rushing around from meeting and meeting here. We're in this hall under fluorescent lights and everyone in suits and ties.
Yeah.
Are you thinking daily about what this all means for Palau, for your home country?
That's probably the hardest part. It's the pressure. It's the pressure to deliver on behalf of not only your country, but your region. You're essentially the voice of those that could not come, the voice of those that are the most vulnerable. So it's a heavy load to carry, but nevertheless, a worthwhile one, but I'll be honest, it is taxing. Yeah, sorry, I got a little bit emotional.
Throughout the day, Matsutaru gets pulled to the side of hallways or into empty meeting rooms for hushed but urgent chats with other negotiators. And he is constantly on his phone, looking at the latest drafts of negotiating text, figuring out who's going to which meeting, messaging allies from various coalitions. You have a lot of WhatsApp messages.
Yeah, it's overwhelming. Which is very typical to, okay, great, thank you, we'll be there.
If the morning was for smaller meetings with allies, figuring out how to reach a common goal, the afternoon has bigger meetings and higher stakes. Matsutaru says at these meetings, he likes to listen and build relationships.
How do you do that? You talk to the person next to you or on the other side of the table. And you do it with a cup of coffee. I'm like, hey, what do you think about this? Understand their perspective. That way I know where's my entry point, where I can engage.
The Paris Agreement is largely voluntary and based on consensus. Building that consensus takes a long time with nearly 200 countries. 6 years after the agreement was penned, negotiators here at this COP are still finalizing its details.
This COP might be the COP where its credibility will be redeemed, or it'll dig itself a deeper hole. What good is a broad-based agreement if it doesn't save us from ourselves?
At around 7 p.m., I finally dragged chairs into an empty meeting room and managed to catch Matsutaru for a sit-down interview. He talks about his job back home, where he's been working with people whose homes frequently flood.
So we've been consulting with them, And their response is, rather than us moving, why don't you protect us? And there's not much. It strikes a core a little bit because they're stuck and we don't have the actual resources to help them out.
Right after he says this, though, he wants to shift the focus of the conversation to what they are doing. Taro farmers are experimenting with raised beds and salt-resistant crops. The government's offering low-interest loans for people who want to relocate. And Matsutaro hopes financing will be made more accessible at this summit so Palau can develop a strategic plan for those vulnerable to flooding. But first, more long days here in Glasgow. What are you going to do tonight to unwind when you get back to your hotel? How do you relax?
Normally a beer. I kind of like the fish and chips here. They're pretty good. I'm not going to lie. Helps me knock out, get into that deep sleep for the next day. That's the routine.
For The World, I'm Carolyn Beeler at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, Scotland.
With its proximity to the Middle East, the Mediterranean island of Cyprus is receiving huge numbers of migrants. Nearly 2,000 arrived in October alone. The geopolitics of Cyprus are also pushing migrants toward the island. Since 1974, it's been partitioned between its Greek and Turkish-speaking communities. But as Andrew Connolly reports from the capital, Nicosia, the government is now taking a hard line on new arrivals.
When Kalthar Razlan saw the lights of Cyprus twinkling in the distance, she thought that she'd finally be safe, until they saw the Cypriot Coast Guard. It was early evening when they approached us, and we were afraid, she told me. After a day and a half traveling, we'd run out of water. My daughter was in my lap, and she could barely speak. Battling waves on the Mediterranean Sea with her husband, two young children, and dozens more Syrian refugees, they set sail from the coast of Lebanon, barely 100 miles away, in late August. But there was almost one more passenger. Kalthar was 9 months pregnant. The Coast Guard eventually agreed to take her on board their vessel. I got into their boat, she recalls, and my husband tried to follow me with the kids, but the police didn't allow him. I was trying to say, children, my babies, but the police said everything would be okay. So I left my family there and they took me to the shore. After being taken to hospital, Kalthar gave birth the next night, but her joy was quickly cut short. Speaking to a nurse using Google Translate, she frantically asked about her family. The nurse handed her back the phone. The message read, "They've been deported back to Lebanon." Fleeing airstrikes on their Syrian hometown of Idlib in 2017, Kalthar and her husband crossed into Lebanon but struggled to make ends meet. Now in Cyprus, the 25-year-old mother cradles her two-month-old baby Yazan at a refugee camp in the south of the island. Syrians are usually granted asylum in the Republic of Cyprus, but with a stipulation that doesn't extend to reuniting family members. On top of that, last year Cyprus signed an agreement with Lebanon to take back anybody trying to reach the island by boat. The government says it's trying to crack down on people smuggling, but Corina Droshutu from the Cyprus Refugee Council says it's having the opposite effect.
So what we've been seeing since 2014 and onwards, which is when the status started to be given to the Syrians, is that many people would come here, they would get the protection, they wouldn't be able to bring their family, and that just opened more smuggling routes, with people being forced to bring their families in very dangerous, risky ways.
Turkish-speaking Cypriots in the north and their Greek-speaking counterparts in the south are separated by a UN-patrolled buffer zone, 112 miles long, dotted with shell-damaged abandoned buildings, with movement controlled by checkpoints. It runs right through Nicosia, making it the world's last divided capital city. When they fled Cameroon's civil war, N.J. Grace and Daniel Ejube had no idea about this distant island or its fractious politics.
When we had the opportunity to come, like opportunity came to travel, we just grabbed it because we needed safety. It was not really easy down there.
Turkey is the only country in the world that recognizes Northern Cyprus, so they were able to fly there via Istanbul Airport. But soon after realizing that the north was a breakaway territory with no functioning asylum system, they attempted to cross into the south, but were caught by UN peacekeepers. Now the south won't let them in, and the north won't let them back. They're now living in a tent behind the Home for Cooperation Community Centre for more than 5 months.
And I'm just wondering, like, you guys have been here since May. How do you spend your time?
It's really boring. It's not easy. Most of the time, it's either we are on the internet, because thanks to the Home for Cooperation, they've given us their passwords. So we're mostly on the internet and sleeping the whole day.
NJ and Daniel, in their early 20s, are from Cameroon's discriminated English-speaking minority, who live in areas where the government is fighting an insurgency.
Back home is it's a disaster, really. It is a disaster. The town where we were living, army will come, invade the area, they will be shooting indiscriminately. So people run for their life, and most of them now live in the bushes. So there's no network, we can't communicate to family.
At the Community Centre Cafe, Nikos Tremiklinyotis, Professor of Sociology at the University of Nicosia, says that the Cypriot government needs to honour its legal commitments to asylum seekers.
If we are serious about being a country based on the rule of law, or democratic rights, and a recognised country, they should accept all applications.
They are worried about creating a precedent that if they allow these people to submit an asylum claim in the Republic, then suddenly everyone will try to cross through the buffer zone.
Why have asylum procedures anyway? The logic of asylum is everybody will be dealing with an individual case, we have a right to apply.
The Cypriot government has still not responded to the world's request for comment, but its interior minister, Nikos Nouris, has previously said that it hosts the EU's largest number of asylum seekers per capita, and that the rest of Europe must provide more funding and resettlement places. But this is of no use to Razlan, separated from her family, or Grace and Ejube, all three fleeing unsolved wars and trapped in the purgatory of another one. For The World, I'm Andrew Connolly, Nicosia.
Today, F.W. de Klerk, the last president of apartheid South Africa, died at the age of 85. He'd been receiving treatment for cancer. De Klerk was a white Afrikaner. He came from a political family, and for most of his career, he defended apartheid. That changed in 1990. After releasing Nelson Mandela from prison, he worked with Mandela to end racial segregation and apartheid in the country. For that, both leaders were awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1993. We're joined now by Dave Stewart. He's the chairman of the F.W. de Klerk Foundation and had worked closely with President de Klerk over the years. First of all, Dave Stewart, our condolences to you.
Thank you very much.
Could we start with F.W. de Klerk's background? How did that shape his early politics?
Well, F.W. de Klerk was born into an Afrikaner nationalist family. His father was a prominent politician, and their goal was to reestablish an Afrikaner republic in South Africa. When he was born, the rest of Africa was under colonial domination. In the United States, you had Jim Crow laws. It was a different universe. So that's what he grew up with. And as he went into politics, he began to realize how impossible it was going to be to retain a right to Afrikaner national self-determination in a country where Afrikaners were a diminishing minority.
But for years, publicly, de Klerk defended apartheid. What argument did he use?
Well, they were looking for some kind of solution that would allow all of the peoples of South Africa to have self-determination, but it was nonsense. And I think he began to realize that. Reform wasn't going to work. There had to be transformation. And de Klerk accepted that. And he dedicated his presidency to the abolition of apartheid.
And when that idea came to de Klerk, why didn't he immediately say, let's just transform the whole system?
Well, mainly because he would have been kicked out of office very quickly. The whole process of changing a society is fraught with difficulties. The real challenge is to persuade your support base to go along with a process that will inevitably undermine their position. And that was his great skill.
Well, later in life, de Klerk apologized for apartheid, including in this video your foundation released.
I, without qualification, apologize for the pain and the hurt and the indignity and the damage that apartheid has done to black, brown, and Indians in South Africa.
Mr. Stewart, I have to ask you, that video was posted today on YouTube. When did President de Klerk record that message?
He recorded it about a month, 6 weeks ago.
What was he feeling so close to the end that he felt necessary to repeat once again that apology for apartheid?
Well, it's because that's the way he really felt about it. He really felt very bad about the enormous harm and damage and indignity that had been done to so many generations of non-white South Africans. So he wanted to record that as part of his testament.
As I think about de Klerk's words in his apology, the news today almost comes across the board as de Klerk was the man who ended apartheid but waited too long. Did you ever hear him reflect on that?
No, I don't think he thought that he waited too long. History and politics moves at their own pace. If he tried to do in 1980 what he did in 1990, it just simply wouldn't have worked. He would have been kicked out of power very quickly. So the real challenge for statesmen as opposed to politicians is to watch the tide of history and to ride the wave when it breaks and to realize when it's going to break. And that's what de Klerk did. In fact, he has said that his greatest achievement was actually handing power over, not to the ANC, not to President Mandela, but to a new democratic constitutional system. So maybe that's how I will remember it.
Dave Stewart is the chairman of the F.W. de Klerk Foundation, speaking with us about the life and legacy of former South African President F.W. de Klerk, who died today at the age of 85. Mr. Stewart, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Great pleasure.
Many countries today are honoring service members who fought in wars. The day goes back to the end of World War I on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. In Europe, it's known as Armistice Day or Remembrance Day. In the U.S., we're recognizing Veterans Day. Notably, this is the first Veterans Day in 20 years when there are no U.S. troops on the ground in Afghanistan. A quick look at the numbers there. The U.S. lost 2,325 service members during that war. Afghan soldiers killed in action number around 100,000. That's a human cost. The monetary cost of the U.S., about $2 trillion spent on the war in Afghanistan, a conflict that ended with the Taliban regaining control of the country this past August. On this day, we wanted to reach out to our friend Matt Farwell. He's in Fayetteville, Arkansas. He's a veteran of Afghanistan and has written extensively on the war, including his book, American Cipher, Bo Bergdahl and the U.S. Tragedy in Afghanistan. Matt has checked in with us from time to time as the war in Afghanistan changed direction. Welcome back, Matt.
Hey, how are you? Thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it, Marco.
We were thinking about you as today approached. How are you spending this Veterans Day?
Right now, I am chilling on the porch, enjoying some sunshine with my dog and looking at the leaves that are starting to change. And then I think we're going to go to IHOP and get some free pancakes.
I can see you on the porch right now. I'm just wondering, though, does Veterans Day make you reflect on your time as a service member? Is it a different day than other days?
I grew up the kid of a veteran as well and an active duty service member. And so it's always been sort of a different day and almost like a church day where you go and you think and reflect. And for a while after the war, it was really bad day for me, where you overthink and you overreflect and you get very maudlin. My battalion did the longest conventional tour in the global war on terror. That was our big distinction. Our other one is that we have one of the highest suicide rates in the Army. You mentioned the numbers of people that were lost in Afghanistan. That's a huge number. And the number is of the people that were lost because of Afghanistan is even bigger.
We never spoke about the withdrawal in August and the chaos and the optics of the U.S. leaving a country in tatters. What has this year been like for you, and what are you feeling today, knowing that all the U.S. troops have left?
On one hand, I felt since my deployment, 2006, 2007, that the war was not what it was being sold to the American public as, and that we probably shouldn't be involved there in the way that we were. So I'm glad that U.S. troops are no longer in Afghanistan. I'm glad we're no longer fighting that war. I'm horrified with the way that it took place. I mean, three of my interpreters that I'm quite close to, they made it out. These three brothers from a town in Paktika, where most of the town supported the Americans, right? And had since the American invasion. And now they're here, they're in Fort Worth, they're truckers, they're you know, filling a critical need in our economy. They're working their butts off. You know, they make me feel lazy and I work quite hard. Meanwhile, all they can worry about is their mom and brother that are still stuck in Afghanistan, that at like 3 points during the withdrawal, I could have gotten out, but the State Department wouldn't clear it.
Were you playing a role in evacuating Afghans?
I was trying to help my interpreters get some of their family members out, and I failed at that.
It must have been hard. I mean, I know there was a lot of paperwork.
It's still hard. I mean, I'm supposed to... The paperwork wound up being the obstacle. You know, I had them... I could have gotten them on a helicopter and gotten them out. I was talking directly with the helicopter pilots, and the State Department said no.
So, Matt, I want us to hear a moment from the last time you and I spoke about America's legacy in Afghanistan. Here's what you said. I think this is back earlier this year.
I mean, I think it's the same legacy that the Soviet Union left, the same legacy the British left, the same legacy Alexander the Great left. We got beaten by the people of Afghanistan. It happens. It happens to everybody.
How does that comment strike you today, Matt? Even more relevant?
Yeah, I mean, still true and relevant. It wasn't for lack of money or anything else. We lost there. People lose there. You know, the Afghan people are tough. There's infighting amongst themselves, and that's part of why we're trying to get, like, my interpreters' families out so that they can be safe.
I'm speaking with Matt Farwell, a U.S. veteran of the war in Afghanistan. So now we're getting news from Afghanistan about an imminent humanitarian disaster with winter coming. I mean, not much news, though, from Afghanistan. How do you feel about America's attention span with regards to the country?
Oh, it's terrible. I mean, the only time I've had writing directly solicited from me was in the actual week that Afghanistan was falling. And then after that, the attention has completely fallen off.
The U.S. right now is not directly engaged in any major war, but the military is always on alert. And it seems the world keeps looking at the U.S. and wondering what the U.S. is going to do about global conflicts. Do you think that is still the role of the U.S.?
I mean, I think as long as so many people in the United States make so much money off of war, it'll still be the role. And I don't see Lockheed Martin or BAE Systems going away anytime soon.
That's a critique we often hear from the far left in this country. Should we be surprised that a veteran is saying that?
No, because it's a critique that you first heard from a veteran named Dwight Eisenhower when he was giving his presidential farewell speech. He warned about the dangers of the military-industrial complex, and we just finished out a 20-year war that largely existed to serve them.
So, Matt, Veterans Day, it's about paying respect to and honoring those who have served. What aspects of that service are you most proud of?
I am most proud of the people I got to know, the people I served alongside, or that I've gotten to know afterwards because of that service. I'm hard on the Army. I still love the Army. Of any American institution, it's the one that I'm the most emotionally attached to. It gets my heartstrings going, you know? So there's a whole lot. My life and my character and everything I am would not be the same without being a veteran. So I'm, you know, it's an incredible honor for me to be able to, like, join kind of that unbroken line in my family that goes back generations of people that have stepped up and served in the military. And just because I happened to do it in a bad time during a bad war, you know, I'm still proud that I was able to do that and was able to do that with so many fine people. And I just wish that it didn't screw so many of us up so badly.
Matt Farwell is a veteran of Afghanistan and has written extensively on the war, including his book, American Cipher, Bo Bergdahl and the U.S. Tragedy in Afghanistan. Matt, it is always great to speak with you. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you, Marco. I appreciate it. Always great to talk with you, too.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong. Tomorrow's Friday. We'll see you then.